What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DeCebedo, and today we have two stories. First, we discuss the disconnect between CEO pay and reality, and then we get into whether oil platforms are more or less safe than in the past. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Stay tuned. Pay practices come into sharp focus during a crisis, often because of the stark contrast between what an executive has made and the current environment for many. Think of the financial crisis of 2008, where the big three oil company CEOs flew private jets to their congressional hearing, where they asked for taxpayer money to be bailed out. The CEOs got a drubbing. The same went for executives at banks that received massive bonuses after it was revealed that the risk-taking was one of the major causes of why the economy tanked. You also hear about CEOs that say, you know what, we're only going to take $1 this year for our salary as a way to try and signal that they understand what is going on in the world. Also, the ability to say on pay. The ability to vote on whether or not the pay of a CEO is worthwhile is one of the main shareholders' tools wielded at a company's annual general meeting by its investors. You vote in favor of the pay package set by the board of company directors if you think the board has set a fair remuneration package for its CEO. And you vote against the pay package if you think the CEO is not executing the company's strategy well. That's basically the main thing they are responsible for, by the way. And so they shouldn't be stacking all those greenbacks. But CEO pay isn't only used to shame or to avoid shame. It's a powerful incentive tool wielded by companies to attract top leaders to their headquarters or to retain current ones. It's also a tool boards use to align the priorities of the CEO with the company. And the question is, has pay for performance remained an effective guiding tool or not? Because CEO pay right now is higher than it's ever been. And the stock market continues to go up, yet unemployment remains very high and businesses continue to be hobbled by the pandemic. So I think it's a good topic to explore. And it just so happens that my colleague Harlan Tufford finished researching and reporting on the topic. And what he did is he took U.S. CEOs that were in power between 2006 and 2020, and he looked at their pay throughout the entirety of their tenure and checked it against what is called the company's total shareholder return, basically the stock price. And what he found was pretty surprising.
What we found was that the CEOs who ever saw the strongest returns in our sample, who you know, performed the best, really, on average, they received the lowest pay, right? And that kind of flies in the face of what we would expect to see when we think about performance pay and its purported incentive power. Even more surprisingly, when we look specifically at realized pay, so the pay that the CEO takes home at the end of their tenure, right? The top performing CEOs generally did quite a bit better than the worst performing CEOs in our sample. But compared to the middle of the pack, compared to the average CEOs, there wasn't really that much of a difference. The best performing CEOs earned only 3% more than the CEOs who oversaw average performance.
So what he's saying there is that pay and performance is misaligned in the US. The best performers only earned a bit more in realized pay than the average performers. And CEOs who oversaw the strongest shareholder returns in our sample actually received the lowest awarded pay. And now here's where you got to pay attention, because I'm throwing around a lot of terms that, if you are like me, seem kind of arbitrary. Mainly the difference here between realized and awarded pay.
Awarded pay, which is the number most of us are familiar with, that's the number that usually makes the headlines. But the biggest part of that is equity, right? And the equity numbers and awarded pay, they're not actual numbers in a bank account. They're estimates that the board's made. That's a reflection. It's a reflection not of what the CEO is actually going to get, but it's what the board wants to pay them, how the board is incentivizing the CEO, right? And then we also look at realized pay, right? So awarded pay is the forward-looking estimate. Realized pay is the backward-looking certainty. Realized pay is talking about what the CEO actually got, right? So it's the outcome of pay. And what was interesting about this paper is that we were able to look at both of these, you know, in the context of the person the board was actually trying to incentivize. And we could see how pay actually played out over the course of their tenure. And the result was that when you look at one measure of company performance, total shareholder return, the monies that the CEOs were realizing over the course of their tenure weren't necessarily lining up with the performance the company experienced over that tenure. And that's really at the heart of pay for performance.
And it's hard to easily say why that is because pay has become really complex. A lot of the disconnect between pay to performance is attributable to how pay plans have developed over time. Initially, pay was just to incentivize CEOs by better aligning their interests with those of investors. But over time, the sheer complexity of these pay packages and all the different pieces and performance targets and peer comparisons have resulted in a major disconnect between the theory and the practice of pay, between the intent and the results. And so when you see the Google co-founders or Elon Musk or Jack Dorsey of Twitter or some other high-profile CEO boast that their salary is a dollar, what is really happening is that they are getting the lion's share of their income from the market. And if you have a market, as we do now, that is continually going up, it is hard to tell if a CEO is just riding the wave or if they are actually creating value for a company. And so what Harlan has tried to do with this paper is to try to sort through that complexity and assess how the individual CEO affects the company and assess whether the system of pay for performance seems to be working. And what he's found, as he noted, is that it's not a great tool to assess how a CEO is actually doing. So what does this mean? What does it mean that the system of incentivization is breaking down at the highest levels?
I think it raises questions for investors about, why are we comfortable and supportive of this pay structure, if the function that it's supposed to be fulfilling of incentivizing performance and serving as a tool that drives investors, that drives executives to reward investors, if it's not actually playing out the way it should be.
And I think it gets even more complicated than that when you start to think about what's being incentivized here. This is one of the oldest ESG questions. How does pay influence the performance of a company? And what they're talking about there is how does pay influence a shareholder return? Now, the question on my mind is total shareholder return the right metric to measure company success? What if all this misalignment with total shareholder return is actually fine? It's just the company's CEO guiding the company in a better direction than in rising TSR. Maybe they are doing something better environmentally or socially. So I tried to talk to Harlan about that, and we kind of both agreed that we don't really have the data right now to opine on that at the moment, whether TSR is the right metric for success. So I leave that to you all to muse on. And instead, what I did is I just asked Harlan if he could give me his opinion on TSR in general, being the metric that we look at when we talk about CEO pay performance and whether or not it is successful.
It's appropriate in the sense that it embraces that shareholder-centric view that has been at the heart of the pay for performance discussions for a long time. And it's also helpful because it's at the heart of the equity awards that many CEOs receive, and some performance stock awards will actually use either absolute or relative TSR to influence their vesting. So it's ingrained in the system in a way. But as we start to move toward a more stakeholder-centric conception of the corporation, and start to look also just goals that are maybe more long-term in nature and that are not necessarily captured entirely by share price, there may be an appetite to start incorporating other metrics both in the structure of pay plans and in how we judge those pay plans and their efficacy.
And all this is even more important as the conversation in our world starts to grow about income inequality, which has gotten so much worse during the pandemic, and the large salaries many CEOs are currently taking home. For example, Jeff Bezos is worth about $200 billion, and the average Amazon warehouse worker salary is around $32,000 a year. The problem is when you talk about non-executive worker salaries and executive worker salaries and try to compare them, you're talking about two different ships that are on very different oceans. The market is the mechanism of payment for executives, yet for hourly workers or for non-executive workers, wages theoretically, and I stress theoretically here, are determined by the price that someone would provide an hour of labor for. There is a lot of complexity in labor rights issues and general mispricing in the market that I'm glossing over. But that is all that usually the executive team looks at when they discuss worker pay. It's an easily defined line item, while CEO pay is more ideological and influenced by factors that are not always in the company's control.
When you look at the pay between a retail worker and a, you know, a CEO, you have to think about pay as a tool, right? And for the retail worker perspective, who's generally just getting a fixed hourly rate, the only real purpose pay serves is retention, right? It keeps them, that employee, on the job, punching the clock. For the CEO, for an executive who participates in a more sophisticated pay structure, pay serves a second function of incentivization, right? And that's where that kind of paying them with market forces aspect enters in, right? Because the lion's share of CEO pay is not cash, it's equity, right? It's stock awards and to a lesser extent stock options. And that's where these enormous pay figures, where, you know, we saw one CEO who made $1 billion over the course of a tenure, right? These are extraordinary amounts of money, and they're being driven by market forces, by equity, and that's the system working exactly as intended, because the purpose is to reward executives where market forces reward shareholders, right? So when we see that happen, that's not a glitch in the system. That everything's worked correctly from the perspective of the pay committee.
The big structural problem there, the larger ESG issue, aside from whether a tool that investors and companies try to use in order to ensure its leaders run the ship well, is that such large sums being paid without evidence of merit can lead to deep structural fissions between labor and management. And after sifting through all these numbers, I wanted to know if Harlan, who is not an executive, by the way, I have to say that, felt moralistic about all these large sums after spending so much time with them, and whether he had an opinion about if someone should be making $1 billion a year, if he let those kind of thoughts creep into his mind.
It's something interesting that, much as those big numbers may jump out at us and cause a real visceral emotional response, it's hard for anyone to say that you can go this far and no further, or that this number on an absolute basis is too big. And that's why we look at pay in a lens of alignment, looking at it compared to performance looking at it as a tool and trying to measure what it achieved, rather than trying to understand just saying that this number is too big or something like that.
And something he and everyone else on our governance team is going to watch is if that tool begins to break down, and then if you couple that with the fact that during the pandemic income inequality has risen, are you going to see a situation where there's going to be more investor revolt against pay practices? And you're going to see a situation where CEOs and executives are going to be under fire for the pay they take more and more into the future, and what that might mean for decades to come. Black strips of oil appeared on the Mediterranean coastline this week. Volunteers as far north as Haifa in Israel and as far south as Ashkelon near Gaza are working to clean animals and rocks as they struggle under the tar. It was the first reported oil spill this year. In 2020, though, there were relatively few oil spills recorded, though there were some, and they were devastating in scope, but still, relative to other years, there were fewer occurrences. And luckily, there were none of what are termed large and severe oil spills, the ones that usually happen when something goes wrong at an offshore oil platform. Think of the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster that saw 4 million barrels of oil flow from a damaged oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico over an 87-day period. These spills are incredibly destructive to the region's biodiversity. Animals lose their ability to repel water and insulate from the cold, or they ingest it, or their lungs are damaged by it. The list kind of goes on. But disasters as they aren't that easy to predict. They happen in a flash. But often what we find afterwards is that with proper regulation and safety checks, the disasters need not have happened. And the good thing is, we are finding that due to increased efficiency, we have fewer active wells at sea, and those wells are being reviewed by regulators more often. It's something my colleague Chris Cote just finished researching, and due to the tragedy in the Mediterranean, I wanted to get a hot take from him on some relatively good news about the regulation of the oil industry, so I called him up and asked him what he found in his report.
One trend we've seen is that after the BP oil spill in 2010, you know, the production in the Gulf of Mexico really fell off, but it's picked up a lot since then. So there's been a lot of growth in oil production, like 25% growth over the last 10 years until COVID, of course. But with that, we've seen fewer wells as they've been more efficient. And that's made the job of the regulators a little easier, I think. The regulators are doing more inspections per well over this time, and we're seeing fewer incidents per inspection, right? So they go out to the rig and they do their inspections, and they categorize them from kind of a low severity, maybe a light isn't where it's supposed to be, or there aren't enough like life preservers on the rig, all the way up to, you know, a really severe incident like oil is leaking now, or a key component is broken. And we've seen the number of severe incidents decrease over the last few years. So the regulator seems to be doing more of its job, and companies are responding to it.
So I'm looking at your report right now, and you wrote that BP stood out as a large producer with a low warning rate compared to the peer average, and notably Shell's inspections went up significantly in recent years without a corresponding increase in incidents. But producers like Eni and Equinor and ExxonMobil had a high level of warnings per inspection, as did W&T Offshore and Talos Energy, that also stood out with a higher warning rate, but to a lesser degree than Eni, Equinor, and ExxonMobil. You also wrote about the fact that production is ramping up in South America, and what did you find there?
Just to link us there, so the Gulf of Mexico, the U.S. Gulf of Mexico production in 2020 was about 1.5, 1.6 million barrels a day. Brazil has seen tremendous growth over the last 5, 10, 15 years. It's accelerating, and it's now producing over 3 million barrels a day, so double the Gulf of Mexico production. And then there's two other emerging areas as well. Near Brazil, you have Guyana, which has its first production at the very end of 2019 through 2020. And then Suriname is more of an exploratory environment, but, you know, is looking to start producing oil soon as well. And I think one thing, you know, I point out in my research, and, you know, one concern we have is that these countries that have less experience regulating the offshore industry, so especially Guyana and Suriname, more so than Brazil, they, you know, are passing more of the risk on to the companies, essentially, to self-regulate. And I think that increases the likelihood of some problem down the road, right? There's more checks they need to do on their own, and more corners that could be cut. And I would say that, you know, going forward, as the oil industry continues to be squeezed, you know, in terms of demand by regulations and policies related to climate change, that companies are going to be, you know, looking at an opportunity to save costs, and, you know, who knows what corners might be cut down the road as well.
And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Harlan and Chris for joining me to discuss this week's news with an ESG twist, and I wanted to thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. That always helps out when I have to defend myself to my bosses. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, and talk to you next week.
The MSCI ESG Research podcast is provided by MSCI Inc.'s subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research LLC, a registered investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. and this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or a promotion or recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.